It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Multiple explosions in Cairo take at least 2 lives. International community focuses on urgent humanitarian needs in Sudan and South Sudan. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Egyptian security officials say 3 bombs exploded outside Cairo University Wednesday, killing a senior police general and a civilian and wounding several others, including a number of police officers. Here's VOA's Elizabeth Arrett.
Security forces have been the target of frequent attacks since the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi last year and the continuing crackdown on his supporters in the Muslim Brotherhood and others opposed to Egypt's military-backed government. The Sinai-based jihadist group, Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, has claimed numerous attacks on police and military targets. Others appear to be carried out by less coordinated anti-government militants. Officials frequently blame the Muslim Brotherhood, which the government has declared a terrorist organization, and accuses of fomenting turmoil across the country since Mr. Morsi's fall. The Brotherhood has denied the allegations. Even before the bombings Wednesday, fears had grown that the crackdown on the opposition could provoke a backlash. Cairo political analyst and journalist Mohamed Abdallah.
Many Egyptians believe that many young people are going to join forces of terrorism in the near future. As long as there is not an open way for political participation, the substitute will be violent.
Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
African and European leaders focused much of their attention Wednesday at a Brussels summit on the Central African Republic's crisis. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saying he'll press world powers to provide more security and financial support. Leaders of 70 African and European nations are attending the summit, including British Foreign Secretary William Hague.
We're very concerned about the situation in the Central African Republic, particularly the violence against Muslim communities there. So we want to see African and European peacekeeping efforts successful there. We want to see agreement on a UN peacekeeping force, more humanitarian aid. I'll announce today another £6 million of British humanitarian aid for the Central African Republic.
The European Union has agreed to deploy a temporary force of up to 1,000 troops to CAR. They'll join some 6,000 African Union and 2,000 French troops trying to protect civilians and disarm militia. The foreign peacekeepers currently focused on protecting Muslims being attacked by mostly Christian anti-Balaka militants. Tens of thousands of Muslims have fled their homes in recent months. Many have taken refuge in neighboring countries. Also at the 2-day summit in Brussels on achieving closer political and economic ties is African Union Commission President Zami Dlalima Zuma.
The African continent would like to have a continental free trade area by 2017. This may be ambitious, but it's something that we want to achieve in the near future.
The 2-day meeting focused on climate change, migration, and development aid issues. A British official attending the inauguration of an international effort to address Sudan's humanitarian needs warned those needs are astonishing and can't be ignored. Kate Turton of Britain's Department for International Development said the situation in Darfur and South Kordofan is rapidly deteriorating. The United Nations estimates it will take $1 billion to meet the needs of more than 6 million people. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports desperate South Sudanese fleeing their country's fighting must eat grass and roots to survive. The World Food Program has begun a costly airdrop of relief supplies in the northern part of that country. Erthrin Cousin heads the WFP.
Traditionally, we wouldn't be here because we would have pre-positioned food, which would have given us the ability to have a distribution that was much more systematic to support the needs of the most vulnerable in this community. But because of the conflict, we're now in a situation where we're airdropping food to get to people so that they have food that they haven't had access to for the last several months during the conflict period.
An estimated 1 million people have been displaced by the fighting in South Sudan, which erupted in December. That includes 800,000 who are internally displaced and more than 250,000 who have fled to neighboring countries. In Guinea, foreign mining firms have locked down some of their operations and pulled out some international staff. As the death toll from a recent outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus reportedly surpasses 80, Guinea exports bauxite and gold. The World Health Organization says there are now nearly 130 suspected cases of the Ebola disease, which has also spread to the neighboring countries of Sierra Leone and Liberia. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Many of these stories can be found at our internet website, that address, voanews.com.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, sitting in for James Batty. Today is Thursday, April 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A new survey shows Malians are optimistic about their country.
By December 2013, 67% or two-thirds now thought that the country was going in the right direction.
Mike Bratton is lead researcher of the Afrobarometer survey in Mali. A U.S. government official says tens of thousands of South Sudanese are at risk of massive food insecurity. We'll tell you how some of South Sudan's biggest employers are hoping to use sports to bring people together. And Rwanda is gearing up for the 20th anniversary of the genocide that killed up to a million minority Tutsis and politically moderate Hutus.
I personally started public speaking 10 years ago in the U.S. because I was challenged by someone who tried to tell me that what happened to me, what took more than 1 million people, my people, was not a genocide.
Yvette Rugasaguhunga is second counselor at the Rwandan embassy in Washington. And we will have details about a project that aims to support businesses and entrepreneurs searching for clean energy and climate change solutions in Africa. Those stories plus Marco Ume's sport and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malians are optimistic about the direction of their country after last year's election of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, according to an Afrobarometer survey released this week. Mike Bratton, a lead researcher of the Mali poll, says the survey showed that nearly 7 out of 10 Malians, that is 67%, say the country is moving in the right direction. The poll was conducted in 2013 following a peace agreement that ushered in stability in parts of the country's north that were strongholds of Islamic insurgents. The survey, Bratton says, was an effort to try and assess public opinion following the peace agreement. It allowed Mali's National Army to take charge of the country's north, which Islamic militants controlled. Bratton told me earlier that the survey, which was released this week, shows that Malians are also hopeful the new government will implement economic measures to improve living standards.
The survey in Mali was a special effort at the end of 2013 to try and assess the state of public opinion in the aftermath of the very difficult year that Mali had had in 2012. What we found was that there had been a considerable shift in the public mood, whereas at the end of December 2012, 75% of Malians thought the country was going in the wrong direction. By December 2013, 67% or two-thirds now thought that the country was going in the right direction. And remarkably, in the north of the country, even higher proportions thought that the country was going in the right direction. So basically, there's been a rebirth of optimism in Mali.
So let's go into the reasons why they seem to be enthusiastic about the prospect of the country's progress or the direction of their country.
Well, one of the main factors is safety and security. About 60% of Malians now think that the country as a whole is safe and secure. This contrasts very strongly with the way they felt at the end of 2012, when only 17% thought the country was safe and secure. It should be noted, however, that people in the north are much more cautious. Only 44% think the country is safe and secure. And when we ask people what they think the most important problem is that facing the country that the government should address, more people say political instability than mention any other factor. The factor that they mention second, however, and this is throughout the country, is food insecurity.
How enthusiastic were they about the government they elected and how the government has outlined plans to help them to strengthen the country, stabilize the country, and ensure that the people benefit from the policy direction of the country?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's another very important factor in explaining this uptick in the public mood. People also attributed their positive feelings about the country's direction to the high quality of the elections that were held in 2013. There was a presidential election in July 2013. in which IBK came in, and there was a parlementary election in December 2013. In quite an extraordinary finding, 83% of Malians said that they thought that the presidential election was completely free and fair. This is the highest level of approval for an election that we've ever found in the Afrobarometer, compared to less than 50% in other African countries, and compared even to the 74% of Senegalese who said that their most recent election was completely free and fair.
Mike Bratton is lead researcher of the Afrobarometer survey in Mali. He spoke with me from the U.S. state of Michigan. A high-ranking U.S. government official says tens of thousands of South Sudanese are at risk of massive food insecurity. Nancy Lindberg is the assistant administrator for the U.S. Agency for International Development. She told reporter John Tanza the situation in some parts of the country requires immediate intervention. Lindberg says the U.S. will resume its development project, but only if leaders in Juba create a stable and accountable democratic government in South Sudan that will bring a lasting solution to the crisis.
The United States has walked this path with the people of South Sudan for nearly 20 years. We have applauded, we have supported the vision of the people of South Sudan for a peaceful, united, democratic country. It is tragic that their leadership has not been able to keep the country on this pathway. The United States is very much committed to continuing to support the people of South Sudan, and we deeply hope that there will be a peaceful pathway that reemerges very, very soon for the sake of so many people who fought so long and hard, many of whom are on the brink of massive food insecurity.
You have been helping people who are in need, and the question that begs an answer here is that when do you do development and when do you do relief?
There's a third question, which is also how do you do relief in a way that builds resilience, that helps people not just to stay alive but to become more resilient? The question about development, true development, requires accountable, legitimate, participatory governments. And when you have that in place, you have the core ability for a country to manage conflict and to withstand crisis and disaster. When you don't have a partner, when there is not an accountable, legitimate, democratic government, all of your development investments are at risk. And so that becomes the most important element.
Last year, you gave a lot of money for media development in South Sudan at a tune of $65 million to help strengthen the media in terms of being independent and also help the civil society to do their work. But there are reports that South Sudanese journalists are facing constant harassment from security operatives. And here is a situation that you have put so much money in that project. Are you still optimistic that that money is going to strengthen the media in that country?
Well, I met a number of journalists and other civil society leaders when I was there, and I can say that these are incredibly impressive people who care deeply about the future of their country. And it is very regrettable that constraints are being put on their work and their activities, because a true successful democracy requires that people have access to information and that people have the ability to hold their government accountable. What I heard and am heartened by is that when people have the information about what's going on, they are better able to call for a peaceful, united future. And I think a lot of people in South Sudan right now want peace. They don't want to raise arms against their neighbors. And so it's important for the media to be able to continue to put that message out there so people understand that this is not a war against your neighbor. This is not a conflict with somebody just because they're a little bit different than yourselves. This is, regrettably, a conflict between leaders who need to come together, stop the fighting, and get back on the pathway to peace.
Nancy Lindberg is Assistant Administrator for USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development. She was speaking to reporter John Tanza. Some of South Sudan's biggest employers are hoping to use sports to bring people together. They held the first of what they hope will become monthly events recently in Juba to promote peace and harmony among the nation's various communities. For VOA, Mugume Davis Rakarinji filed this report.
Hundreds of people gathered to eat, dance and play some football at the Nyakron Culture Center, as employees of the city's media houses, banks and health centers gathered for friendly football matches. Event organizers call it Corporate League, and they want to hold tournaments every month, pitting teams from different companies against each other.
If you put people together through sports, then you can have harmony and peace in an area.
Richard Matimbo is one of the Corporate League organizers and the human resources manager at Victoria's Health Clinic. He says the games are about more than having fun.
For the last about couple of months, there's been war here. So we're trying to see how we can get guys back to sports so that they forget about the trauma they had and they get together through sports.
Matimbo says each company is expected to provide their employees with uniforms and refreshments after the matches. The marketing manager of Cooperative Bank, Moses Eresto, says the possibility of getting to know other young professionals in the city drew him to yesterday's event.
I have met so many people that I could not have met if it wasn't because of this corporate league. To me, I'm looking at it in terms of making friends, and definitely when you have so many friends, you become a peacemaker.
Ikatu Rebecca says she was just wandering by the cultural center when she heard the sound of the fans and decided to take a look. She says she's impressed by what she saw.
Since this brings many organizations, companies coming together, people can get to interact and get to know more about other people, other people's lifestyles, and so on.
Gabriel Daniel, a technician with the South Sudan Television, says the simple sporting event might have a national impact.
We need to people to come together in this moment. We know how is South Sudan now, because if some people, it is coming together and to know each other, that is the importance of the sport. And the sport can promote the peace between different people here in South Sudan.
Event organizer Richard Matimbo says they are planning to expand to volleyball, swimming and billiards in the coming month, so even more people can participate. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rakarinj in Juba.
It's Thursday morning, April 3rd, and you are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Ahead on our program, Mark Omer's Sport and our Listener of the Day. Rwanda has begun a series of commemorations in the lead-up to April the 7th called Kebuka 20. Here to tell us more about the event is Yvette Rugasagahunga, the second counselor at the Rwandan Embassy in Washington.
Kwibuka means to remember. It's a Kenya-Rwanda world. And Kwibuka 20 can be translated as the 20th commemoration. And like the years before, we thought instead of waiting for April, we wanted to start this conversation a little bit early to reflect on the causes and consequences of the genocide against Tutsi, and to truly work with the international community to reflect on what we have learned, if anything, from the genocide.
Now, 20 years, the commemorations have been going on for some time now. What would you say is the most significant about this particular one, the 20th one?
What makes the 20th big is the time that has passed, is the healing. It is the accomplishment. It is the fact that in 1994, Rwanda completely collapsed. We died as a nation, and we have slowly but surely resurrected. So I think we're not just mourning the 1 million. We are not just remembering the terrible loss, the tragic loss, the grief. We are celebrating Rwanda as it is and life as it is. And as a survivor, I can add that to that. We are celebrating the resilience of the people of Rwanda, but first and foremost, the survivor's spirit that really has pushed the nation where we are.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that there's a series of events back in Rwanda, but also worldwide, including here in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a few of those?
Yes, we in the U.S. launched Kwibuka 20 February 24th here in Washington, D.C. It was a very moving and very powerful international conversation. We did have the U.S. Senator Russ Feingold, who is representing a special envoy of the President Obama to DRC and the Great Lakes region of Africa. We did have Dr. Adama Dieng, who is the undersecretary slash special advisor to Ban Ki-moon in genocide prevention, and other high-level people who wrapped their arms around Rwanda and truly had a candid conversation. And one of the things that I always remember that we all took away, among so many things, I think it was Senator Feingold who reminded the world that Rwanda might have suffered from the genocide, but let Rwandans be Rwandans before they are survivors.
And that's very critical. Many say mm-hmm. that one of the biggest lessons that has to be learned is that for never again to be a reality, you have to have true reconciliation. There have been voices in Rwanda mm-hmm. of concern that actually there have been victimization of people. We do hear that there are some today, if they have some kind of opposing kind of position to the government, they get accused of being genocide deniers mm-hmm. or terrorists. And so what's your response to that?
Genocide denier, as well stated by Dr. Stanton, Gregory Stanton, as the eighth stage of the genocide, mm-hmm. has been one of the challenges that we face as a nation, that we face as survivors, that we face as Rwandans. Genocide denial is not necessarily opposing the government. Genocide denial is when you take the history of genocide and you alter the historical
facts. But is it used against opponents of the government sometimes?
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that. And obviously, you know, we have to look at case by case. But I personally started public speaking 10 years ago in the U.S. because I was challenged by someone who tried to tell me that what happened to me, what took more than 1 million people of my people, was not a genocide.
That was Yvette Rugasa-Gahunga, second counselor at the Rwandan embassy in Washington. She was speaking with reporter Vincent Macori. The Ethiopia Climate Innovation Center opened recently in Addis Ababa, where the hub aims to support businesses and entrepreneurs searching for clean energy and climate change solutions. The World Bank-sponsored project is just one of 8 centers planned. The next center is scheduled to be built in Ghana. Michael Ayers is a business incubation specialist with the centers. He talks to Ricky Shryok about some of the ways they hope to create both jobs and clean energy.
And the idea is that developing countries are going to be the hardest hit by climate change. But at the same time, there's an opportunity for developing countries to benefit their local industries.
In Ethiopia, agriculture in the country makes up about 46% of the GDP. Fluctuations in rainfall have been affecting agriculture all over sub-Saharan Africa recently. How is the Climate Center hoping to address this issue?
The rainfall patterns change. They decline in some places and go up in others. In Ethiopia, may actually increase because it's scheduled to get warmer. But agriculture that's rain-fed depends on very consistent rainfall patterns. And when they change, farmers are immediately impacted. So technologies such as solar-powered irrigation, drip irrigation, can really help farmers adapt for low cost to these climate change challenges within agriculture.
It's also looking at ways that normal households in Ethiopia can decrease their energy consumption. The making of injera, which is the bread Ethiopians, I think, mostly eat on a daily basis, if not twice daily basis, it says it accounts for 90% of all household energy consumption. One local entrepreneur developed an efficient biogas stove that could reduce the wood consumption needed for injera. So the center will be looking for developments like that then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the 90% of household energy use is both from the entrepreneur. So just to be clear, we haven't validated that. But yeah, traditional cooking methods are both dirty and unsafe for the folks that do the cooking. And they also create a lot of deforestation because traditional wood biomass stoves people just get firewood from the local forests. So if you can use a different type of biomass, biogas, to power these stoves, you can really save a lot of forest. The amount of emissions coming from forest degradation is large. Actually, it's by degrading forests, they're not absorbing CO2 like they used to. You can power stoves, you can power lanterns from a variety of sources, including compost from agricultural waste.
Your organizations at the center will help over 3.1 million Ethiopians increase their resilience to climate change, and it's expected to create more than 12,000 jobs over the next 10 years. Where are these 12,000 jobs going to come from?
Businesses that will be supported by the center, and then the likely impact those businesses will each have on economic growth, on jobs, on social outcomes such as access to energy for rural households that may not have had access to energy, but with an off-grid renewable energy solution, they can get access to energy, access to cleaner water, because there's some businesses that can be supported by the CICs that help to purify and provide clean drinking water.
That was Michael Ayers, the business incubation specialist with the Ethiopia Climate Center. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Ghana's capital, Accra. It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with gymnastics. Benin's Rosette Auxiliatrice Tabusu is among a crop of new gymnasts who made an impression at the recent African Gymnastics Championship staged in the South African capital, Tshwane. Paddy Chadwick, the Union of African Gymnastics Women's Technical Committee President, explains.
And it was extremely impressive to see Benin, which is a very small country. They had a woman taking place in the seniors. She only did floor, which was very impressive. She didn't participate in vault, beam and bars, but on floor she put together something of a very simple routine, but she did it very nicely. And wow, did she have the crowd behind her. It was very impressive to see that they really got behind her and everyone acknowledged her presence.
And then we have other countries where we know only them for basketball or handball. Angola, I saw them there and I was a bit surprised.
The newcomers this time were Angola. I was astounded. I knew they were coming, and I honestly did not know what to expect, and I was so impressed. They were well prepared. Again, you can see that they're new. You can see that they have some way to go, but they've competed in Europe, and they've been training in Portugal. That's obviously the Angolan-Portuguese connection, and they have some cooperation with Portugal who've helped them with their preparation. They're here as a team, and honestly, I was impressed. The girls look really, really lovely. They were sharp, slip. Their bodies look really well conditioned.
That was Paddy Chadwick, the Union of African Gymnastics Women's Technical Committee President, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. Turning to football, no African women's national team improved their position, while Morocco and Tanzania slipped by the widest margin, according to the latest FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland. Nigeria's Super Falcons are Africa's highest-placed team in 34th place and is among five African teams that maintained their ranking over the 3 months under review. Cameroon is 49th. Ghana 50th and South Africa 52nd. African champions Equatorial Guinea are 53rd, Ivory Coast 68th, Tunisia 71st, Algeria 74th, Morocco 77th and Egypt 82nd. It's a cause for concern that at least 10 African countries have not played an international match over 18 months, while Burkina Faso, Kenya, Liberia and Sierra Leone have played less than 5 international matches in the same period.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. That's it for this Thursday, April 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporter Ricky Shryok, managing editor William Eagle, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, and Peter Clote in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa. But please stay tuned for International Edition next on The Voice of America.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent
to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.